Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we take the sources you provided, in this case, the profound dialogues of Joseph Campbell with Bill Moyers, and really trying to figure out what matters, stripping away the cliches.
It's so important to do that with Campbell. I mean, his ideas have been flattened by their own popularity.
Follow your bliss, right?
Exactly. It's become this, you know, platitude about finding the right job. For Campbell, it was a radical, almost spiritual instruction.
That's it. So our mission for this deep dive is all about precision. We want to get past the slogans and into the really hard distinctions he made.
Like the difference between a personal myth and a collective one.
Yes, and why he thought our shared sense of meaning collapsed. And maybe the toughest one of all, his argument that life doesn't actually need a purpose, that it needs something else entirely.
It's a big task. I mean, he didn't just study myths. He was synthesizing everything, history, religion, psychology. We're going to look at the huge decision that shaped his whole life and his diagnosis for the modern world.
Okay, let's jump in. To really get Campbell, you have to start with his break from the academic world. It's such a telling story.
It really is. He was, by all accounts, a brilliant student in the traditional sense. He got his BA in 25, his MA in 27, both from Columbia, medieval literature.
But then he went to Europe.
And that changed everything. In Paris and Munich, he's not just studying old texts anymore. He's seeing Picasso, reading James Joyce. He's absorbing Freud and Jung. And this is crucial. He's encountering Eastern philosophy.
So he comes back to Columbia for his PhD with his head full of all these connections.
Connections between medieval romance, modern art, depth psychology, Sanskrit.
And he hits a wall.
A big one.
A huge one. I mean, what Campbell wanted was to study mythology comparatively, to read across every culture and discipline he could find and build this grand synthesis.
But the academy wasn't having it.
No, they wanted specialization. They said, pick one thing, Arthurian legend. Go deep on that. Write a very narrow dissertation. It was all about structure, not this sprawling curiosity.
And he refused. He refused. He saw that structure as crippling. He was already seeing these deep patterns connecting everything, and they were telling him to ignore them. He wasn't interested in being the world's expert on one tiny thing. He wanted the whole map.
Which led him to do something that sounds almost unbelievable today. He just walked away.
He withdrew from the doctoral program. He didn't stop learning. He just abandoned the official path. And that's when he started what he called his 5 years of bliss. He moved to a little shack near Woodstock.
And just read.
Just read. He designed his own curriculum. He was reading primary sources, Sanskrit texts, Native American stories, myths from all over the world. Not summaries, the real stuff.
There's that great quote from your sources, something like,
I read what I wanted to read 12 hours a day, every day.
12 hours a day. You know, that sounds like an absolute fantasy for so many people stuck in that programmatic life we're going to talk about.
It is, and it shows that real intellectual synthesis, the kind of thinking that creates something genuinely new, it often happens outside of the normal institutional incentives. He was building the foundation for the hero with 1,000 faces, completely on his own terms.
It's a powerful lesson for you, the learner. The most important education can be the one you direct yourself. But we should clarify, he did eventually go back and get the PhD, right?
He did, yes, in 1941. But that's the key. The credential came after the real intellectual breakthrough, not before. The work defined him, not the degree.
So that self-directed foundation gave him a lens that almost no one else had, and that led right to his sharpest critique of the modern world.
Let's shift there. What did he actually say about our lost myths?
Right. It's the biggest oversimplification to say he just declared myth dead. That wasn't his point at all. He was talking about scale and cohesion.
Time.
His core claim was that for a myth to really function, to organize a whole society, you need a pretty stable cosmology, a shared social order.
Which modern life just completely shatters. Completely. Technology is changing so fast. Science is replacing the old symbolic stories. We have total pluralism. Life just moves too quickly for one single cohesive myth to form and hold everyone together.
So the shared worldview is gone. The symbols don't stick anymore. We don't have a shared, what did he call it, a mythic order.
That's the exact distinction. A mythic order is a story that organizes your society, your rituals, your morals, everything. That's gone. What we have now is mythic storytelling.
Like Star Wars.
perfect example. It uses ancient archetypes, it moves millions of people, but it doesn't tell you how to run a government or bury your dead. It's powerful entertainment, not spiritual order.
It's catharsis, but it's individual. It doesn't bind the community together with real authority.
Exactly. So this whole shift forces each person onto their own much more personalized mythic journey. You have to look to artists, to filmmakers, to literature to get those archetypes that religion used to provide.
But wait, isn't that the whole American ideal? That you're supposed to create your own story? I mean, isn't this individualization a good thing? Progress, even.
It's both. It's liberating, for sure, but it's also profoundly destabilizing. Campbell's warning was that the need for myth, that deep human need for meaning, for belonging, it's permanent. It doesn't go away.
So when the shared communal language for it collapses, it leaves a void.
A dangerous void. And his point was, when you have a symbolic vacuum like that, something will always rush in to fill it, usually power.
That feels incredibly relevant right now. You're saying the psyche defaults to needing that shared story, and if a real transcendent one isn't available, we invent cheap substitutes.
We invent pseudo-myths. That's the mechanism. They work by hijacking that permanent need for meaning. They give you a simple, emotionally charged story that makes a complicated world seem simple.
What are some concrete examples of that today?
Well, the obvious ones are things like virulent nationalism, which gives you instant, powerful tribal identity, or certain conspiracy narratives. You know, they provide a simple story with clear good guys and bad guys.
A simple cosmology.
A very simple cosmology. But you also see it in subcultures. Think about the intensity of hustle culture or extreme biohacking. They have rituals. They have an us versus them mentality, a clear goal for salvation. But they replace mythic depth with, you know, metrics and achievement.
So our modern anxiety isn't just economic, it's symbolic. That makes so much sense. Okay, let's go deeper to the most philosophical part of his work, how he saw God in purpose.
This is where he gets really radical. He completely rejected the idea of a personal, external God, you know, the old man in the sky who intervenes in our lives.
So what did he replace it with?
He called it symbolic realism. The idea is that God isn't an entity out there. It's a symbolic name for a transcendent experience that happens inside the human psyche. Divinity is a metaphor for your own psychological depth.
Okay, hang on. Unpack that. So if every spiritual experience is basically an act of deep self-discovery, what does that mean for religion?
It means you can preserve the emotional power and the spiritual intensity of religion without needing to believe in the literal dogma. When you look at a symbol of God, you're not looking at something external. You're looking through it, into the depths of your own being.
Myths are public dreams. Dreams are private myths.
That's his perfect formulation of it. The divine, the sacred, it all operates through the structures of our own minds.
And that leads directly to his idea about purpose. Because if the divine is internal, then looking for some external pre-written purpose for your life is looking in the wrong place.
Completely. He really pushed back on that modern obsession, that constant question, what is my purpose? For him, purpose is just a concept, an idea. Life doesn't need to mean something. It needs to be lived. He called the direct experience of living rapture.
And this is why Follow Your Bliss is so misunderstood. It's not about finding a better career.
Not even close. Bliss, for Campbell, is a state of being. It's those moments when your sense of being a separate self, that little ego that's always calculating and managing, it just dissolves. You're just aligned with the energy of life itself. That's bliss, being fully alive.
And that changes how you see suffering, doesn't it? If you're chasing an external goal, suffering feels like a failure, an obstacle.
Right, it feels like a mistake. But if you're just participating in life, suffering is part of the experience. It still hurts, of course, but it doesn't shatter you because you're not clinging so tightly to a specific outcome. You're participating in the totality of it, pain included.
It's interesting to compare him with Viktor Frankl here. Frankl, in the concentration camps, found that having a why, a meaning, was crucial for survival. They seem to be saying opposite things.
They do, on the surface. But I think they can coexist. Frankl is talking about psychological survival, giving the mind a reason, an orientation to endure the unendurable. Campbell is a step beyond that. He warns that the search for meaning can become its own trap.
The journey becomes the destination you never arrive at.
Exactly. So Frankl gives you the compass to survive the storm. Campbell tells you how to become the storm, how to dissolve the self that's fighting it. They both locate the power for transformation entirely inside the individual.
And this brings us to his critique of the programmatic life.
Yes. He was so wary of goal-driven living. When that's all you do, Your consciousness is always pulled into the future. Life becomes a checklist of milestones. You're always trying to get somewhere, and you miss the fact that you are already here.
Living for a tomorrow that never actually comes. It's exhausting just thinking about it.
Yeah.
And it's all tied to his idea of time.
Completely. Linear time for him was a kind of trap. It binds us to past regrets and future anxieties, and the present just becomes this thin little slice we rush through.
Which leads to his redefinition of eternity. It's not endless time after you die.
No, it's timeless presence. It's the eternal now. When that goal-seeking mind finally pauses, linear time loses its grip.
What does that actually feel like, though? For you listening, what's a real-world version of that eternal now?
It's that feeling of flow. When you're so lost in something, writing, painting, a deep conversation, even just running, that you forget to check the time. The ego disappears. Past and future fall away. You are just doing. That feeling of the present moment expanding, that's Campbell's eternity.
So what religions call heaven isn't the place you go to later.
Not at all. The ultimate implication is that heaven isn't afterlife. It's the depth of life when it's fully lived. And the programmatic, achievement-obsessed life, it literally blocks our access to it. This is his diagnosis. Our chronic anxiety and burnout come from being temporally dislocated. We're a society that has forgotten how to simply be.
That brings us full circle, from his own self-directed education to the collapse of shared myth, and finally to this focus on presence over purpose. The bliss is found when you stop searching so hard and just participate.
And that's his challenge to us. It's not just historical analysis. It's a prescription for how to survive mentally and spiritually in a world where all the old maps have been torn up. Trade the tyranny of tomorrow for the freedom of now.
So, if Campbell was right, if political ideologies and conspiracies are just pseudo-myths filling a void, that leaves us with a final provocative thought for you to take with you. What contemporary movements or powerful brands or even technologies are hijacking that fundamental human need for meaning today? What's offering a cheap, quick sense of purpose when real transcendence feels lost? That's the real deep dive, and it's one for you to explore on your own.